Live from Texas, it's John Mayo with the Mayo Report.
So we're going to be talking about the numbers for August 2007. Where do you want to start this month, Chris?
John, I want to talk about your article that you write for Comic Book Resources, your latest one, and just go over some highlights that caught my attention. Is that all right?
Yeah, certainly. It's always nice to have somebody read my work.
Let's start out with your Thor number 2 little blurb that you had regarding the numbers on Thor. And why don't we talk about that real quick on the number side, and then I got a question for you.
Okay. All right. Now, Thor, we're talking about the monthly stuff because the new series hasn't gotten to where it'll hit a trade yet. And it started in the number one position last month in July. And typically what'll happen on a new title is it'll launch pretty big, and then it'll have a second issue drop. Now, this happens regardless of the quality, the creative team, the character, or anything. By and large, this tends to average around 21.8%. Now, I'd kind of expected Thor to fall victim to that. And if it had, it would have landed at about 129,225 units. That didn't happen. It came in a lot less than that. It came in at 108,609 copies, which is a drop of about 43.73%, which on the one hand seems really, really harsh, but I kind of think that this is an odd case where the strengths of the books almost acted as weaknesses. High-profile character, high-profile relaunch, high-profile writer with Straczynski. And it may have been not that it was over-anticipated, but, I mean, it's been so long since there'd been an ongoing Thor title, and enough has changed in the readership and the market, etc., that, I mean, this had to be really hard for retailers to figure out how many copies they could sell. And, you know, we're seeing a case where they aim high, hoping to, you know, have what they need to meet the demand, and then start cutting back severely, fearing that they may have overestimated. Now, it's going to be at least 6 months or so before we find out how this title's really doing. Because it takes that while for the thing to, for a title to get out of the honeymoon period where retailers are you know, waiting to see how readers react to the title.
Now, you say 6 months, and that does not equate to six issues.
No, and 6 months is a ballpark. Right. Sometimes we can tell sooner, sometimes later. But it's duration of time. For other titles such as Countdown, 52, the upcoming thrice-monthly Amazing Spider-Man, we're going to have a lot more issues in that honeymoon period. And I'm counting the Amazing Spider-Man thrice-monthly kind of as if it's a new title, because in many respects it is in terms of the sales trends.
Right. Now, the reason why I'm bringing Thor up is because this week Marvel announced that it is going to be reprinting Thor 1, 2, and 3 into its own little mini trade, if you will. And it is going to come out November 7th, they've got a date, a week after Thor number 4 comes out. And interestingly, there's no price associated to this book yet. But my question to you is, do you know offhand, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, is did Thor number 1, 2, or 3 get a second printing at all? Or are they just, is this a second printing with this little 100-page giant, if you will?
I don't know of any second printings. I'm not going to say there aren't any.
Yeah.
I would be very surprised if there was one for the first issue, just because its sales were, you know, so high. It did, you know, 165,325 or so units, which ought to be plenty to meet the demand. Now, this isn't the first time we've seen Marvel do this kind of a mini trade, if you will.
Right, I was going to bring that up, yeah.
They did the Marvel must-haves a while back, and they seem to, at times, prefer doing this to reprinting issues.
They did it for a couple issues of Spider-Man tying into Civil War, as I recall, too.
Yeah, yeah. I have to question how effective that is and kind of the impact it has on the readers. Because if I were a reader, say I missed one of the three issues of the first three issues of Thor, I'm not really going to want to have to spend money for all three of them if I only need one of them.
Right.
So in that respect, reprinting would do better. from a retailer perspective, I think that's going to vary from store to store and from, you know, customer base to customer base. I think if they could keep the individual issues available in the long run, that's probably going to be better for them.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, down the road, 4 or 5 months from now, we're, you know, looking at Marvel's track record, we're probably going to get a premier hardcover out of this thing, collecting, what, the first 6-issue story arc that we're probably going to see. So the redundancy factor is right square with Marvel and this book, it seems.
But, I mean, we're seeing that all over the place, particularly with high-profile items. I mean, look at the number of ways that they've already packaged Civil War. You've got the original monthlies, you've got the trade, you've got the Civil War Chronicles. Yeah. And they've already announced a hardcover. Cover, haven't they?
Nothing definite yet. No date on anything yet, but I'm sure we'll see it in 2008. An omnibus style or something.
Yeah, I thought they'd mentioned they were going to do it, but yeah, not a specific solicitation yet.
Right, yeah. Oh, they will. Yeah. They'll get something done. You know they will.
It seems to me that by offering even more choices on format, that I think there's a little bit of a cause effect here. I don't think there's necessarily a direct one nor necessarily a provable one. But it just seems to me that as more and more options for how you can get a given story are become available to readers, that by and large, the sales keep dropping. Now, I think they're dropping anyway, so again, I'm not saying it's a cause and effect, but certainly it changes the decision-making for readers of, you know, should I get Thor number 3? Well, you know, they're going to have it collected with the other two, I can get that, or I can wait for the trade, or I can wait for the hardcover, or I can wait for the eventual omnibus. It gives readers an easy out to not buy the item now. And I think that's fundamentally changing how comics are bought.
Okay. I next want to talk about a little bit about Star Wars. Later on in your article, you say the top-selling comic book for Dark Horse this month was Star Wars Legacy number 15, coming in at number 88. One of the questions I have is, we see the mega events from DC, we see the mega events from Marvel, and now, come 2008, we're going to see a mega event from Dark Horse in their 4 Star Wars books that they have. And it's going to be called Star Wars Vector, and it's going to be going through Knights of the Old Republic, Rebellion, Legacy, and Empire. My question is, what is Dark Horse doing here? Are they really... You see Star Wars Legacy number 15 at 88. Are they trying to boost up this line at all with a mega crossover event like that? Or is this... I mean, what's your take on this? I mean, I'm a Star Wars reader, and I'm not sure you are.
I read one of the titles. I'm only reading Knights of the Old Republic.
Knights, okay. And what do you think about this? I mean, should they be getting into a mega event? Or, I mean, what's their motive behind this?
Well, it's certainly an event. I'm not sure if I'd consider it a mega event or not. I mean, part of this is all definitions and semantics.
Well, right. I mean, yeah.
It's only 3 or 4 titles. This is like just the Batman titles crossing over. It's certainly an event or whatever, but it's not like an entire publisher-wide 30 titles involved sort of fiasco that we see at Marvel and DC. I don't really think, from my perspective, not working at Dark Horse, not knowing how many issues they need these things to sell or for, you know, whatever reasons, I don't know that they really need to shore up or enhance the line any. I don't think it's doing badly. Matter of fact, I think it's doing reasonably well, reasonably stably. So, from that perspective, I do think there's a little bit of a risk going for this kind of event. I also think, now, again, I'm only reading Knights of the Old Republic, so I'm not totally up on what's going on in the other titles, but aren't they set in different eras?
Exactly, yeah. Going thousands of years in the past with Knights, and then more in the current, around the movie mythos, with Empire and Rebellion, and then with Legacy, there are 150 years in the future, something like that, after A New Hope. 120 years to 150 years, I think. I don't have the exact time frame in front of me.
Right.
But, yeah, it's something like that.
This reminds me of when the Star Trek novels started crossing over between generation and generation. You would have something happen to Captain Pike's crew, it would follow up with Kirk, then we'd see Picard do something about it, and then, you know, the Deep Space Nine crew with Sisko, and then Voyager, and then, you know, now they're tossing in Enterprise and stuff, and it was kind of almost convoluted at times. And that was actually about the time I kind of bowed out of the Star Trek novels. And I've got to think that they run that risk with the Star Wars titles. And clearly, given that there's a difference of, you know, 10 or 12,000 between, say, how Star Wars Legacy is selling and Star Wars Rebellion, that obviously they're hoping that people reading Legacy will start reading Rebellion and Knights of the Old Republic, but there's just as likely a chance that it's going to go the other way and they're going to lose some readers. But this all depends on the specifics. They've got really good creators on these things. We're only talking, you know, three or four titles. So it could work out for them. It could really re-energize the entire line.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting story to see what they do with it and to see if the ongoing backstory or the ongoing string or theme that will be going on through the titles throughout the thousands of years is going to be in your face or if it's going to be in the background going on in the comics. And not really, if you could pick up a Star Wars Legacy, like number 19, and read that comic by itself. And, you know, and then there's one long, drawn-out storyline underneath. Like, kind of like what they do in Fell, how they're all, like, single issues. But if you read the whole trade paperback, you can see the whole storyline in its entirety.
Well, I mean, clearly, accessibility is the key to success, I think, for any title in any storyline. If people can't get in either in the middle of it or at any point, and figure out what's going on, they're not going to enjoy the story.
Right.
So I think that the people, you know, certainly Marvel, DC as well, but certainly at Dark Horse, I think they understand this. But, you know, it all comes down to execution. You know, can they tell a good story? Can they make it accessible? Can they keep people interested? Or have we hit a point where enough of the readership has gotten jaded and cynical enough that they're simply going to look at this announcement, say, oh, wow, it's a cheap sales gimmick, and write it off as such? I certainly hope they don't do that. I mean, if they've got a good story to tell, I'm all for it. But, you know, I'm going to have to decide when it hits that point in the solicitations, and I don't know if it's with the new previews or not. But, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to get the other titles or not? I don't know yet.
Yeah, I will be. I want to jump down, and I remember my question, and this is a real layman's question, and you'll be able to answer it, no problem. You write in one of your paragraphs, I want to stress about 52 and Countdown. It says, I want to stress that this is an apparent jump in sales with issue number 13 of 52 and number 39 of Countdown, which may or may not reflect the actual change in sales. This is because Diamond calculated the index for returnable issues as a, quote, reduced level to account for possible returns, and this is the point at which the issues stopped being returnable. Now, regardless of 52 and Countdown as it is, my question is, what is a returnable item, and why?
Okay.
You know, what is that all about?
There are different reasons a title can be returnable. Okay, and 52 is kind of, and a Countdown are a special case in this. Typically, a title is going to be returnable if it is substantially different than the way it was solicited. Different artists, different contents, different characters, different story, whatever. Theoretical examples of this, and I say theoretical because these are the guidelines and it's not necessarily hard and fast. Not everything gets held to, I don't want to say the same standard, that's not fair. Sometimes things that I would think should be returnable may not be returnable. I just want to clarify on that. But theoretical examples would be the sixth issue of Superman Confidential, where they started a new storyline and they're going to finish that one up wherever. The sixth issue of Wonder Woman, which the original contents of that, I think, just came out in the Wonder Woman Annual. A couple of issues of Action Comics where they kept having to push back the Richard Donner storyline and have essentially, I don't want to say fill-in stories, but replacement stories. That's one reason why something could be returnable. Another reason is if it is substantially late, typically that's 90 days or over, or 3 months, I should say. And the technical definition is like end of the third month after it was originally supposed to come out or something like that. So it's not like an actual 90 days, count it, bam, it's returnable. It's an end of month sort of thing. This is one of the reasons why you tend to see a lot of publishers, typically the smaller press, indie ones, but certainly Image as well, on the last week of the month just having a flood of stuff coming out, because if they don't get it out then, they run the risk of it being returnable. I say again, run the risk, because one of the items that just came out this week was Savage Dragon, and that's, I'm thinking, 30-some-odd weeks late. And if we look at, you know, the comics list for August, there are a couple other items that, you know, came out, were not returnable, yet still shipped just egregiously late. You know, in some cases, months late.
Wouldn't there be a cancel on that and a resolicit on an item that's 30 weeks late?
There ought to be. In some cases, I've seen it go as long as 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm saying these are kind of guidelines, not something that everything is held to. I honestly have no clue what criteria comes into play or why some things don't get held to this or not. And I certainly don't think it's a matter of playing favorites or anything like that. You've got to keep in mind, there's over 5,000 things that get listed in previews every month. And a heck of a lot of them do come out. So there's a lot of things for Diamond to keep track of and attempt to police. And I'm sure this isn't, you know, a high priority item versus, say, oh, getting the books actually to the stores. 52 and Countdown, though, the reason those are returnable was this was done to a partial returnability. I think only 20%, but I could be, you know, I might be wrong on that because, you know, I'm not a retailer. I don't have all the inside information. And what DC did is they allowed a certain percentage of it to be returnable to mitigate the risk to the retailers. Because DC realized that, you know, once that initial level of sales is kind of set, it's, you know, unlikely to go up from there. So the better they can meet the initial demand, the better off everybody is. And this, particularly with 52, which was the first real weekly series like this for a big major event for DC and Marvel, there have been other weekly things, Action Comics Weekly, but those were kind of different beasts in many respects. DC had this be returnable, again, I believe to about a 20% ratio, to give retailers a little bit of a cushion, to encourage them to order more. So what Diamond did is, again, they calculated it at a quote-unquote reduced level to account for this. And the actual phrase they used when they released the data was that phrase I had in my article there, which was a reduced level to account for possible returns. Now, I don't know, again, the behind-the-scenes math or exactly what they did. My supposition would be they essentially said, we had this many orders, potentially 20% of them could be returned, let's report it at that 80% mark. Whether that's actually what happened or not, I don't know. And I haven't had time to go, you know, chase that down at Diamond yet. And really, it doesn't matter. But in this case, with both 52 and now with Countdown, when we get out of that honeymoon period after that 3 months, that's when that partial returnability kind of cuts off, and we're seeing what appears to be a jump. So in this case, this may strictly be an artifact of the mathematics on how the data is reported. That's why I wanted to kind of clarify that in my article.
Okay. Moving on, I'm gonna stick with DC for 1 minute, and I want to talk quickly about a series that I kind of think may have gotten lost in the shuffle of Countdown and really had a hard time finding its own identity, and that was the Outsiders Five of a Kind. And I say it kind of got lost in the shuffle because It takes place during Countdown. It takes place sort of after Amazon's attack and ties in Amazon's attack, and it kind of bridges the gap between the old Outsiders team with Nightwing and the brand new Outsiders team with Batman. And essentially they are 5 one-shots, and you could read them as standalone issues, but really it's a 5-issue limited series. But it doesn't tell you that. And again, going back to the final issue, which was the Grayson and Wonder Woman team up, it really tied up the loose ends as sort of an epilogue to Amazon's attack and kind of showed Wonder Woman where she's going back to, and then looking at Grace, where she is going to be headed going into the Outsiders. What do you take from this title? Is it stretching when I say it doesn't have an identity?
Well, it's a weird title in a number of respects. It's a unique title, I should say, in a number of respects. They're using it to bridge the gap, like you said, between the two kind of eras of Outsider. But what's interesting is it takes place before Outsiders 50.
Right.
And not after Outsiders 50, where one might expect, since that was kind of the shift between Nightwing's team and Batman's team. The other thing that makes this unique is it's a weekly miniseries. And if you look at the sales curve on it, it's very similar to the sort of trends we're seeing on Countdown in 52, where you see a little bit of a loss after that first issue, which is kind of the knee-jerk reaction for retailers of, number ones are going to sell better, let me pull back on a second issue. And I totally think retailers are making a sound judgment there when they do that. Then we see a very minor drop-off of only about 1% or so between issues after that. This is, again, more or less what we're seeing on Countdown in 52, and quite possibly what we may see on Amazing Spider-Man once it goes thrice monthly. But again, way too early to tell on that. We need some data first. So, you know, I found the frequency to be a unique aspect of it. And then, like you said, that last issue, which was billed actually as a countdown crossover, was really, like you said, an epilogue to Amazon's attack, and a very strong one at that. Yet there was no mention of that on the cover, although there was on the solicitation blurb. I'd be very interested to know what the sell-through rates on these various issues were, and if they were pretty solid or consistent, or if they varied based on either the characters or, in the final issue's case, what it claimed to be a crossover with and what it was a crossover with.
It might do well in trade, though. You never know when it comes out.
It might, but it doesn't... I mean, certainly it'll be a trade. It'll be, you know, the Outsiders five-of-a-kind trade. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
It'll do okay. It'll do this, probably the same standard numbers that any Outsiders trade would do. But it's really five very standalone storylines...
Right.
With a little backup feature that kind of loosely ties everything together. I don't know. I mean, it was a satisfying read as a miniseries. I'm sure it'll do, you know, be the same as a trade. But it's not one of these that makes me think that it really is best suited as a trade and may do surprisingly well. I think there are a few other titles that will do, I think, potentially better than average as a trade. I put Supervillain Team-Up MODOK 11 in that category.
Yeah.
Because I think that Undersoul is underselling, I should say, as a monthly, and it's a really good one, a good series, and I think it may do surprisingly well in trade.
All right, let's move on to the top collected edition in August, which was 100 Bullets Volume 11. And I'm mentioning that we'll get out of the top 10 trades in a few minutes, but it came in at an estimated 7,712 units. And you write, this is the lowest-selling top trade for the month since June of 2006, when the Power Girl trade sold an estimated 6,153 units. This is very significant, John. You know, it's, you know, what do you make of this? I mean, just people are not interested in trades this August, or what?
Well, it seemed, you know, and part of the challenge I had when I was writing the article for CBR this month is I looked at this list of trades, and it wasn't that sales were bad. Sales were okay. But nothing really jumped out at me as a really huge, big item, or just, gosh, I've got to talk about this, or something that was just fascinating with the sales stuff. And part of it was kind of, generally, kind of lackluster and stuff. And again, and that's not to say anything bad about any of these items, because a lot of them are really good. But the top 12 or 13 items did worse than average for their respective slots. And the number one slot was down about, I'm going to say, 4,674 units from the average number one level. Now, that would be around 12,386 or so. And again, this only did 7,712 units, which isn't bad. And again, this is a Vertigo title for DC. It will probably have a very long shelf life, both in the comic stores and will do very well, no doubt, in the bookstores. So there's nothing to panic about here for anybody. But, you know, it's interesting that, like I said, the top dozen or so ranks, and this has nothing to, sort of does have something to do with the titles, obviously, but not specifically for the titles. But again, the top 12 things did worse than average, and almost everything else did better than average. So we seem to have a slightly weaker than average top dozen or so items this month, which is interesting, particularly since one of them happened to be Watchmen, which is a reorder.
Yeah, I saw that.
And the Planet Hulk hardcover reorder came in slot 10. So, you know, I'm really not sure what to make of this. It may be that people are just, when it came time to order these, a little low on their budget or whatever. I certainly don't think we're hitting the end of the trade paperback era or market at all.
No, no, no.
If anything, this is just a minor bump in the road, if that.
Yeah, it seemed like a funny anomaly, that's all.
Yeah, well, and part of it is it's particularly funny given how high we'd seen a few things go with the Civil War trades a few months back and some things like that. Again, nothing to worry about. But it does seem just kind of a little odd.
Moving on to Image, what would Image do without Robert Kirkman? Would it fold up?
Oh, most certainly not. Now, Kirkman this month, as I mentioned in the article, just kicked butt on the trade side for Image. He did the majority of the trades for Image.
Yeah, I'll say.
he had all but one item on the list. He had Invincible Volume 3 hardcover, Walking Dead Volume 6 trade paperback, and Volumes 1 and 2 of Walking Dead trade paperback as well, leaving the Surreal Adventures of Edgar Allan Poe graphic novel as the only non-Kirkman Image title on the trade list for the month. So, certainly, he's proven to be a sales juggernaut in many respects for Image, but people tend to confuse that with him making a lot of money for Image. Image got, if I understand the math correctly, and again, I'm not a publisher, I'm not a creator, I don't work for Image. This is, again, you know, outsider, you know, looking in sort of thing. He made maybe $10,000, if that, for Image, and that's because he had four items on the assumption that it cost, or he had to pay $2,500 to Image to do each of those. And that's probably incorrect, because I don't know that he has to do that every time it shows up on the list. I'm almost certainly doesn't. But the way Image works is they get a flat fee for every item they handle. So at one point, many moons ago, he had to pay them a certain amount of money to get that Walking Dead trade paperback, Volume 1, out there. I'm certain he's made that money back by now. I'm certain he's made it back for that Volume 6, which just came out a month or two back, too.
Yeah.
Hell, he's probably made it for Volume 7, which I think just came out a week or two back.
Right, or the Walking Dead omnibus that they had, you know, the limited run
right.
that had, you know.
So, I mean, he's doing great, and it's certainly good for Image in terms of reputation, in terms of prestige, and things of that nature. And I'm sure he's making a couple of bucks for Image. But Image is not raking in money hand over fist on this, as best I can tell.
Yeah. It's just so funny, because we look at Image, you know, every month when we sit down and do this, okay, what's the top trade from Image? Oh, Walking Dead. Oh, Invincible. Oh, Robert Kirkman. You know, it's just always him. It's just hilarious.
Well, there are two things to take away from this. One of them outside of Image, one inside. The thing to take away from this outside of Image is if you ever wonder why Robert Kirkman gets a title like Marvel Team-Up that lasts 25 issues and then ends, Irredeemable Ant-Man that lasts 12 issues and then ends, and they do okay, but not brilliant. And no doubt he's going to get another title from Marvel that'll do okay and then probably end. But eventually he's going to hit big over at Marvel. It's just a matter of finding the right book at the right time for him. Why does he get these opportunities? Because he's got a proven track record over at Image. His stuff will sell. It's just a matter of finding the right fit for him in the Marvel Universe. I think he gets opportunities and maybe a little more leeway in terms of some sales and how long a title will last than maybe some other creators over at Marvel. And that makes sense from a business point of view based on how his books are doing over at Image. Like I said, proven track record. There's a lot to be said for that. Now, the other thing to take away from this is, yeah, he's usually the top dog when it comes to the trade paperback side of things. It's a different issue over on the monthly side.
Right.
More often than not, the top ongoing comic for Image is Spawn. Now, there are other ones that come and go. Frank Frazetta's Death Dealers was the top Image title. There are other ones that have beaten out Spawn. A few of them have even been ongoing. But those are usually, they'll start big and kind of drop down. I think we're at the point where very soon we may see Walking Dead the monthly become the top-selling ongoing monthly for Image. By my estimation, it could happen as early as Halloween, because it's slowly trending up, and Spawn is slowly trending down, and if you look back at the trend, say, from the beginning of last year, they're going to cross at around 23,000 units sometime, again, end of October, November, potentially. That's all other things staying equal in terms of the same frequency, the same sales trends, and of course, past performance is no guarantee of future performance. We could see Spawn just take off like a rocket and Walking Dead tank. I don't think we will, but who knows? So it's going to be fun to watch that. Those are the things we can learn from watching Kirkman, you know, just dominate Image's sales on the trade side. So where do you want to go from here?
So real quickly, do you want to do the top 10 real quick and then move on to market share?
Sure, we will do that.
Okay, we covered 100 bullets pretty much, so we can skip down to number 2, yeah.
Right, the number 2 slot was Amazing Spider-Man Volume 17, Clone Saga. It did 7,689 copies, which is pretty good, pretty good. The next one down is slot number 3, Fruits Basket, also volume 17. It did 6,665 units. I still haven't read this one.
No, neither have I.
But I have read the next item, which is slot number 4, the New Avengers Volume 5, Civil War trade paperback. It did 6,542 units. That is up substantially, about 28.8%, or, you know, 1,463 units from Volume 4. And again, what we're seeing here is the continued strength of Civil War. Next we have, in slot number 5, Batman and Son hardcover, with 4,641 units. And because it has no volume number and it's a hardcover, I've got nothing to compare that against.
Right.
And it kind of bugs me when they do these things with the titles and just kind of toss it out as if it's a free-floating thing. Next up, in slot 6, we've got Showcase Presents Wonder Woman Volume 1. It did 4,610 units, which is pretty good for a showcase. Not great, but not bad at all. A little above average, I think, although I would have to go double-check that.
I think that's a pretty strong showing for what it is, a bunch of Silver Age Wonder Woman.
I would agree with that.
I mean, we've talked about this in the past, and I've always wanted to see where this would come in at, and I think that's pretty good. I'm surprised it sold that well, actually.
It is, I believe, ranked 17 out of the 32 showcases that I have in my database.
That's very good.
So right about dead center, almost.
About half. Yeah, dead center.
So at least in the rankings. I don't know about the numbers. I'd have to check that. Slot 7, Ultimate Spider-Man 100 Project, the trade paperback. That did 4,541 units.
Books like this always bug me because it's a book and it's not a story. You know, it's just a bunch of covers. It's a book.
Yeah, I don't know how they determine which category some of these items go in.
Right.
We've seen that with the encyclopedias and a few other things. It would be nice if what was in here was sequential graphic storytelling.
Right.
Slot number 8 has X-23 Target, the trade paperback, at 3,833 units. That was a pretty good miniseries that seems a little, I almost want to say, soft on the sales side, given the high profile that the character had at one point. But I think they've, I don't want to say squandered that, but they were not able to leverage that as quickly and effectively as they might have otherwise been able to.
Is that series done? Is that over?
It was a miniseries, so yes.
It was a miniseries? Okay.
Yes.
Is that character still around?
That character is showing up in New X-Men.
New X-Men, okay.
Slot number 9, we've got New Avengers Volume 6, premier hardcover, with 3,817 units. And then in slot number 10, we've got some reorder activity for the Hulk, Planet Hulk hardcover, which has shown up one other time on the list, and it did an estimated sales in August of 3,794 units, bringing the total reported estimated sales to 12,905 units.
You'll be happy to know that I did get this in the mail, and I plan on reading it hopefully this weekend.
I think they've done a great job with the Hulk stuff, and
yeah.
I'm really pleased with the World War Hulk event that's going on. I think it'll do gangbusters once it hits trade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a fun storyline. I was skeptical as to how well it would do. It's not doing Civil War numbers, but frankly, Civil War, I don't think, should have done Civil War numbers in terms of nobody had any reasonable expectation that anything would be selling that well these days. For Marvel to be doing as well as they are with Planet Hulk, they should be, you know, definitely commended for that.
Anything else you want to mention?
Well, we've got some reorder for Civil War itself down at slot 16. Another 3,463 units. Got the Batman Secrets of the Batcave of 3,148 units, which I believe you just talked about.
I just reviewed it, yes.
Now, I kind of lost track of what happened with New Universal, but the first premier hardcover for that is out in slot 22 with 2,932 units. As far as I can tell, it just kind of stopped after issue 6, and I thought it was an ongoing monthly.
Yeah, I thought it was too.
I don't know if it's just on hiatus or just kind of over. Always bothers me when they do that.
Huh.
We've got the Complete Peanuts Volume 8, which covers the 1965 to 1966 comic strips in slot 54. That's a hardcover that did 1,909 units. Like I was saying earlier, it wasn't a bad month. There was some good stuff, but nothing that really jumped out at me and said, wow, this did surprisingly well or surprisingly bad or just surprisingly anything. And that's not good or bad, it's just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It surprises me only in so much as so much of the market seems to be driven these days by hype, by anticipation, and sustaining that level of interest. And while there are certainly things on this list that I think manage to do that, it's not like, again, we've got the big Civil War wave of titles coming out or anything else that's just a everybody's been anticipating sort of title.
But there's always another trade, you know, coming around the next month or next 2 months or so. I mean, this just seems to be like a little lull, a little hiatus.
Yeah.
Like you said, we'll get back into the swing of things come Christmas season.
Yeah. Well, and that's true because, I mean, retailers are going to have to start kind of gearing up for what they want to have in the stores come Christmas. So mm-hmm. we may see some stuff kind of creep back up in the sales that may be accounting for some of why the Watchmen activity we're seeing and some stuff like that. And it's also possible that some of what we were seeing in with the Marvel Zombies this month was in preparation for Halloween.
Yeah, that's true.
So let's take a look at the breakdown of the top 100 trades and graphic novels and collected editions.
Okay.
Marvel came in with the most units for August, with 83,927 units. That accounts for 34.9% of the top 100 volume of trades that were sold. And when you factor in the cover price, that accounts for 42.76% of the top trades by dollars. DC did pretty well this month, in second place by number of units for the top 100, with 71,490 units. That accounted for 29.73% of the top list by units and 28.26% by dollars. So just around that 29%, we're back towards how we'd been seeing Marvel, DC, and other kind of all evenly dividing the pie. Tokyo Pop was kind of interesting in third place. It did a strong showing in terms of number of units, with 18,287 units, which accounted for 7.6% of the list by units, but only about 3.94% by dollars. This goes back to their lower cover price, where everything they had was $9.99. On the other hand, Dark Horse, where their items range from $9.95 to $29.95, they had 14,724 units, and that accounted for 6.12% of the list by units and 6.62% by dollars. They did $306,892.80 at full cover price for their trades. Compare that to the total for their comics, which was $548,209.45. And they're the one that seems to have the best balance between how they're doing on the comic side and how they're doing on the trade side, which I think is going to position them well going forward. Because I really think in the coming years, and I've said this before and I'll no doubt say it again, we're going to start to see these comic numbers, I think, start to go down, and we're going to see these trade numbers starting to go up, or continuing, I should say, not starting, but continuing. And we're going to see more of the business shift from the periodical comics towards the trades. Now, we may not see that within these numbers, because I think some of this is also going to be happening through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble, through other mass market retailers, which are able to move these trades quicker and more effectively and at a cheaper cost to the reader.
That's your story and you're sticking to it.
Oh, hell yeah.
I agree with you. I think it's going to, you know, everybody's trying to guess a timetable when that's going to happen. And, you know, oh, we're going to do it in the next 10 years. Oh, we're going to be all digital in the next 15 years. I don't think you could put anything like that on a timetable. It's going to happen when it happens. And it may take a new technology to do that, you know.
Well, the digital thing, I think, is totally separate.
Yeah.
And totally different rules apply to that. But
what I mean is, you know, people are always trying to predict where the comic book market is going to be headed in the next few years. And like I was saying, you can't put a date on it. You can't give it 10 years, can't give it 5 years, can't give it 15.
No, I think what's going to happen, though, is we're going to hit some point, and again, the question is when this point is, when we hit it, where within a short period of time. It's going to be like the teeter-totter and the weight shifts, and suddenly it flips to the other side.
Yeah.
And that sudden shift may take 3 months, a year, whatever. But there's going to come a point where we've crossed the Rubicon, there's almost no going back, and it's clearly the business has to be supported financially by the sales of the trades versus the periodical comics. And we're certainly not there yet, and we've got a ways to go looking at these numbers. But I kind of think the ship has already sailed, and most of us just don't realize it yet.
Well, that's what I mean. It's going to take 5 years from us now, or 10 years from us now, and then we'll look back on the history and realize, oh, okay, 2007 was when we passed the threshold. Or, you know, it's going to be 2020, and we're going to look back and say, oh, 2011 was when we passed the threshold. You can't predict it's going to happen this year, and then, oh, we're in the new era already.
Well, I think, again, there's two parts. When did the dominoes start falling? When did they get to the point where the avalanche can't be stopped?
Right.
We haven't hit the point where the avalanche can't be stopped, but the dominoes have been falling for a while, and that's totally mixed metaphors, I know.
Right.
I think, and I'd have to go look back at solicitation history, and actually, you might know this better than I, but I'm going to say that this all started and almost became, not irrevocable, when it got to the point where DC and Marvel were packaging pretty much every storyline into trades.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been at that point for years, I think, possibly longer.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the minute it got to where you had better than 75% odds of, if I pass on this monthly comic, I know it will be traded, that's when we started going down the road where trades were going to eventually take over.
And if it isn't traded, then people on message boards get very upset.
If it isn't traded, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's the deciding. I mean, because if it's not worth trading, it's not worth reading, apparently.
Right.
I mean, that's the message kind of, I don't want to say being sent by the publishers, but that can be picked up by the readers, if nothing else. Because, again, we've gotten to the point where a lot of people are trade-only readers. They're stopping buying the monthlies. And I got no problem with that. If that's what works for people, that's what they should do. And certainly the publishers have made that a viable option. I think that has the potential of biting the publishers big time.
See, what bothers me in that scenario is when you've got these events, and even like a smaller event, like an Amazon's attack, right? And you have in the solicitation and on the marquee of that monthly book, it says Amazon's attack tie-in. But yet they don't include it in the trade paperback. Only the storyline of issues 1 through 6 or whatever it is in the trade. And that is what really bugs me. If it's good enough to have the moniker on the top of the book, then it's good enough to have the trade.
Yes and no. I mean, the way they're selling...
Because then it wouldn't get traded. It'll get traded in its own book, maybe, you know? I don't know. I mean, that just kind of bugs me. I know that bugs a lot of people, actually.
Yeah, well, this is something that I've given a lot of thought to over the years, because at one point I was going to go into publishing, and my thought was I was going to do, like, an 80-page-a-month book, figuring it'd be the equivalent of a weekly book, but I wouldn't have to do the multiple covers, and I could get some printing savings, that sort of thing. And then every 6 issues, I'd package that up into a trade. That would come out like clockwork. I thought that would be the most brilliant idea. Now, this was like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So long before we actually hit where it's kind of the de facto publishing plan now. But knowing what I know now, I'm thinking, damn, that would have been a potentially very stupid move for a small publisher like myself to do, because you're giving people a guaranteed option to get the story later if they don't buy it now, yet buying it now is what keeps the thing getting published. And we're very much seeing that on titles like Irredeemable Ant-Man. I think we're going to start seeing that potentially on a number of DC titles, which I think are very much in the danger zone of, are they going to stick around or not?
I think you may see that in the Spider-Man books too, with the way they're publishing Spider-Man.
Let's get to the Spider-Man in a second.
Okay.
The DC ones, I think, that are in the danger zone are potentially JLA classified, Catwoman, JSA classified, Checkmate, Shadow Pack, Blue Beetle, All New Atom, Aquaman, certainly. Those are the mainstream DCU titles that are at the low enough sales point that there is no guarantee that they're going to be around a year from now, and I think even that would be highly optimistic. And that's because people are thinking, well, you know, I want Checkmate, I'll just pick it up and trade.
Mm-hmm.
When people can say, this is my favorite book and I haven't read it in a year and a half because I'm waiting for the collected edition, that's all fine and good for them, but it's not necessarily so good for the title.
Would it be wise on DC's part not to publish that in trade then? Or is that the catch-22?
It's a catch-22 because at this point, because everything is going to trade, there is the implication that if you don't trade it, well, what's wrong with it? Why isn't it worth trading?
Right.
And the other thing is we've seen cases certainly with Walking Dead, and I would hope it's true of a number of other titles as well, but that's the one where I can clearly see it in action. People read the trades, that gets them up to speed, then they transition to the monthlies. Now, we're seeing people transition in both directions, but does having a Checkmate trade allow people to catch up on a series they hadn't gotten on yet and then switch over to the monthly? Certainly that's going to be different on every title as to how that dynamic works. But that's information to really know the answer to that. We need not only point-of-sale systems inside of comic stores, and there's a lot of excellent work being done both by Diamond and other people to make that happen, but we need to start tracking the demographics. We need to start figuring out. Ideally, these point-of-sale systems would be able to say that this is a customer that had been getting the trades and is now getting the monthly or vice versa, and capture that information. Because if we can start seeing how that shift happens, and particularly which direction it's going in, that I think is going to tell us a lot about the future of the industry.
Hmm.
Now, on the Spider-Man issue, what I think we're going to see happen there is we're going to see, once Amazing Spider-Man goes thrice monthly, sales on that are going to drop from what Amazing Spider-Man had been doing. They're going to go to probably a little under the average of the sales of that title, Spectacular Spider-Man and Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, the other two titles that are getting kind of absorbed into it. And I think it'll be a little below that average simply because they're going to be people who are getting one title who don't want to get all three, or simply can't afford to, don't have interest, whatever. But we're also potentially going to see that title bounce around a little bit more between story arcs, just because people are going to think, well, you know, I don't care about this villain or this story, whatever. I'm going to sit this arc out. If it's any good, I'll pick it up and trade. And potentially we're going to be seeing an Amazing Spider-Man trade every other month on the trade list.
Right, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, that might be overkill.
Not necessarily. I mean, we're seeing a lot of Spider-Man trades as it is.
Yeah, and X-Men too. Yeah, you're right.
But I don't think we're going to see Amazing Spider-Man have the same sales trend that 52 and Countdown have had. And both of those, I think, are doing reasonably well, but in different ways. The question I have for you on the packaging of material into trade paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
The title that just started up over at Marvel of Marvel Comics Presents.
Mm-hmm.
It has 5 8-page stories for a total of 40 pages, I believe. And these are going to last, some are one-shots, some are going to go for a couple issues, some are going to go for about a year. How do you think they're going to be packaging this up in trade?
You know, that is a damn good question. And, you know, I was trying to think if Marvel, how they packaged the old Marvel Comics Presents series. And I'm not sure if they did.
Well, Bob and I talked about this when we reviewed the first issue on our weekly comic spotlight.
Yeah.
And, because, you know, we were trying to think, you know, again, how are they going to trade this? Because Bob's take on the issue was, while it was good, there's no way he's going to remember enough about some of these storylines in 8-page installments a month apart, given how much he reads. And I think I'm going to be in the same boat. So for us, it may work better in trade. But when that first volume of Marvel Comics Presents came out, that was early 90s, I believe, although I could be wrong on that. But it was long before the every 6 months we kick out a trade mentality cranked in. It didn't have the... It was operating in a different business model than we have right now. And I think a few storylines have been traded, maybe some of the Weapon X stuff.
Yeah, the Wolverine and Weapon X stuff has,
yeah. Some of the other high-profile stuff, but by and large, most of it has not. So it's entirely possible the Spider-Man and the Thing storylines that were in Marvel Comics Presents #1 that just came out a few weeks back, there's no guarantee those are ever going to get into a trade. You know, this is one where it goes back to kind of that decision-making process for the reader of, do I get this or not? Do I wait for the trade? Is there going to be a trade? Is it going to be a hardcover? Can I afford that? When's it going to come out? How long am I going to have to wait? All that crap.
Yeah.
And kind of throws it into chaos. Just from a marketing and sales perspective, the goal for publishers ought to be for this decision-making process to more often than not, or as often as possible, I should say, end up with the reader saying, yes, I will buy that in this format that's available right now. Here's my money. Thank you very much. That's not the direction things are heading.
You know, it seems to me, you know, looking at doing a quick recap, it looks like they're collecting these storylines by character and not by the book itself. And, you know, besides the Wolverine and the Weapon X storyline, Colossus has a trade that collects his run in Marvel Comics Presents. And then there is a Cyclops one called Cyclops Retribution, which has his storyline running through 17 through 24 of Marvel Comics Presents. So it seems like they go by character. But again, if they're a solo story, like a 1 or 2 month thing, it wouldn't, it wouldn't warrant a trade as much, because it's such a quick, 12-page story with ads, maybe?
Well, in the new one, it's 8 pages, so
yeah.
The Vanguard one, which will last, if it lasts long enough to have enough material to make a trade, they'll trade that. The Omega Flight one, I think, is 12 parts. That's certainly enough to turn into a trade. But again, it's the one-shots, the two-parters, and things like that, that maybe they'll just wait until they have enough of those and or to fill up a trade, and that's the volume one of the Marvel Comics Presents trade. I don't know.
Yeah.
It'll be very interesting. I'm just afraid that as good as I thought the issue was, that the small story increments and the duration between issues may not work out for it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's saying, oh, they should do more anthologies. They should do more anthologies. And that's something that I think sounds better on paper than it actually works out for. And you look back kind of historically, and I'm looking more on the DC side of things, because I think DC has done more true anthology books than Marvel has. Because to me, an anthology is something that is not a main feature and an 8-page backup, or essentially a flip book where two things split the title. So I'm not considering Strange Tales when Doctor Strange and Cloak and Dagger split the thing down the middle to be an anthology.
Right, okay? Right.
To me, an anthology is like the old 80-page and 64-page, it was a dollar comic, whatever, that DC did back around the end of the 70s, early 80s, in Adventure Comics, Superman Family, World's Finest, and I'm thinking they did one other title that way. And I recently picked up a bunch of back issues, and they were those exact anthologies. And the funny thing is, they've had 20, 30 years to collect all this stuff into trades, and with the exception of the JSA storylines from Adventure Comics, which were written by Paul Levitz, I don't think any of that has hit trade in any format. Now, maybe a few things here and there, maybe some of the Aquaman stories in a showcase or whatever, but some of them, you know, it may be another decade or two before they ever get collected in any format. So we may see that with the Marvel Comics Presents, we may not. I'm going to be very interested to see how it goes both with the anthology aspect of Marvel Comics Presents and how they trade it.
Mm-hmm.
That and Amazing Spider-Man are the two things over at Marvel that I'm most curious about how the sales trends go on.
Yeah, me too. I think you hit the nail on the head there. You want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much about it.
I think it is too, yeah. It was nice to talk monthlies for a change.
Yeah.
The beginning of the show. It's something I don't do that often.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust.
All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust that needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50.5 or excuse 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as we know now, has not been successfully met in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and English language itself seem to work very differently there.